connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
Okay. So I know everyone's been waiting for us to talk about whatever it is we're talking about today, but there is a quick detour I have to steer off the road to make because there is some funny news to talk about.
Yeah.
Curious news.
We here at NetSurfer Pro, Whirlwind Rides to the World Wide Web, your co-host Galen.
And your host Matt.
We here like to do what we call the detour approach, where we approach with the intro and we immediately swerve left. Because we got some cool news that I definitely know.
It's like a sick drift. Actually, there is one bit of news that is not what was originally planned, but now seems like a good time. I am not just Matt, your host, anymore.
Yes.
I am Matthew Marissa, your host.
Matthew Marissa.
Either one works, or both, if you prefer. Just wanted to get that done as sort of some upkeep. And now on to the real news that's really cool and much more important than whatever that was.
I think it was really cool and very important.
Aw, thank you. So, word has it that Roblox is adding an 18 plus tag.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Oh no!
It's pretty. So soon, if these news sources are to be believed, Roblox will let you mark your place as 18 plus. And let me give context to this. So, Roblox has a lot of problems. A lot of problems that People Make Games has sort of really highlighted in their expose on Roblox. One of the problems that they didn't is the sex lands.
Yeah.
The condos, as they're called. Essentially, this has been a long ongoing issue where... So Roblox is a user-generated content platform where people can make their own animations, models, they can upload images, they can upload sounds, and ultimately... program and create their own mini games. They're billed as games. They're more like mini games, or it's like Little Big Planet or Dreams. Notably, all of Roblox's value is really built by the players, while the engine itself is built by the developers and the various libraries included in their version of Lua. Like the actual things people play are made by players of the game, and there's sort of this bot network that has created the assets for a sex condo game where people go in and drink booze and they make their Roblox figures, which don't look appealing whatsoever, do acts that appear 18 plus, very adult. It's stupid. I don't know why these exist other than to prey on unsuspecting kids, which is horrible.
Yeah.
It's also as this bot network where as soon as they ban one, another one goes up. And one of the biggest problems Roblox has is their refusal to do moderation properly.
Yes.
Essentially, Roblox is billing itself as a kids' virtual world along the lines of like Club Penguin or Toontown. But they're also a user-generated content platform where people can pretty much upload whatever they want. And those two really, really clash because people love taking user-generated content platforms and making them very 18 plus.
Yeah.
Either through sex or violence or stuff like that. And so Roblox, in a just world, would have the world's most well-paid and biggest content moderation team to snipe these at the source, you know. But I guess they just don't, or their auto-moderator is very lacking. They don't have the penis detection code.
Yeah.
And so this has just been sort of a problem that has been reported on before and widely swept under the rug. And it's just sort of the quote unquote dark side that they allow to exist. And I feel like the 18 plus tag is Roblox trying to put the bandage on it of like, no, we have adult worlds now. But if you're familiar with YouTube, that's not going to work the way they want.
Yeah.
Because ultimately that requires the people making those condo levels to self-report as 18 plus, which they won't.
Yeah.
Because that seems to be outside the scope of their MO. And if it does get flagged as 18 plus by like a moderator, that doesn't stop them from re-uploading it on another account, which they're already doing.
It's a band-aid solution to an issue that has needed more than a band-aid solution for a while.
Yeah. This also gives other creators the permission to make 18 plus stuff on Roblox, which is really funny.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with it if it's marked as such and made, like you know, like I don't have a problem with adult content if it is flagged for adults and only adults can access it.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a kind of a non-controversial opinion. And from what I understand, there's already some features of Roblox that you need to provide identification to access. So, assumedly, it's going to require ID to be marked as an 18 plus account, which is, you know, whatever. Not the best thing, but it's the only solution they tend to have for verifying identity.
Yeah.
That a child can't, like...
can't easily just sort of click a box that says, yeah, sure, I'm 18, whatever.
Yeah. Because, yeah, just saying that, oh, it's behind a verification checkmark box doesn't usually work.
I was on the internet in the mid-2000s. I'm very well averse to, yeah, I'm definitely 13 years old.
Yeah, I'm definitely 20. Yeah, I was definitely born in 1970, January 1st.
Oh, man. Can I admit something?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of love Roblox, and specifically, I love Roblox as a villain, and here's why. So often when platforms mess up, does the onus ultimately fall on creators? Like, when we had ElsaGate in the past with YouTube, of like YouTube just blanket allowing a bunch of really fucked up, you know, kids videos that are still there, by the way, and still fucked up, the you know, we had ElsaGate, and then it was like all of the punishment basically went to the creators. Like, theoretically, it should have gone to YouTube. It should still go to YouTube. But it's like, okay, we'll introduce systems that auto-flag, like, cartoons and stuff, which, you know, messes up a bunch of adult content creators who do cartoons. Or, you know, oh, we'll implement a system that if you say fuck in the first 18 seconds, then, you know, oh, your money, your video's demonetized. It's stupid. Roblox... anytime Roblox gets a critical eye looking at it, it's always seems to be on Roblox itself.
Yeah.
And I think that's great, because that's how it should be.
It's funny, like, one of the things in the People Make Games video was about how offsite communities centered around Roblox games and Roblox developers have a lot of, like, harassment and grooming problems.
Yeah.
And it was under the sort of, the thesis of that section of the video was, like, Roblox used to have forums for discussing these things.
Yeah.
And once they got rid of the forums, it forced people who wanted to discuss these to go offsite, which allowed for predatory actors to go in.
Yeah.
And they closed the forums because they didn't want to moderate them. It largely feels like a lot of Roblox's problems are due to just not wanting to moderate things if they don't have to, which feels just like a horrible mishandling or refusal to deal with their own bed they've made.
Yeah.
Like, they want to get all the money of being a kid's virtual world without any of the responsibility.
It's Roblox is kind of a perfect villain. Like, they are, I won't say as transparent, because they're not exactly transparent, but they are, the evil things that they do are so outwardly obvious that, like, you know, there isn't that sort of separation where it's like, oh, you know, maybe they weren't aware of this, maybe, you know, they just didn't have the full oversight. It's like, we know that they knew about this to some extent, and all of their solutions have been to pass the puck.
Yeah, they've been like, eh. It's also funny. Like,
So
I love Roblox because, for one thing, I grew up playing it. I will admit that.
Yeah, same.
But also, like, it's so funny. It's just this thing with, like, these Lego guys, but now they're not just Lego guys. They're also, like, freaks.
Yeah.
They don't look cool at all. I don't even think me as, like, a 10-year-old would have liked them. And, like, the Roblox games nowadays are so mobile gamey with all these, like, money sinks and shit. And that all is other, this is a topic for a proper Roblox episode, but, like, it's so funny.
Yeah.
Like, as someone who is not affected by it and is looking inward from the outside nowadays, it's sad and, like, infuriating, but also just kind of funny. It's this weird hyper-capitalist space of a game. The weirdest thing, this is for people who, I'm not going to explain this in any context, but so every now and then I'll go back onto Roblox and check in on it, see how it's going, see how the community or the culture has changed. It hasn't. but in my most recent expedition, I saw a Chainsmokers Festival tycoon. Why are the Chainsmokers like, oh yeah, we're gonna have branded content on Roblox and it's gonna be a tycoon game?
Yeah, so many. Okay, Fortnite did a concert. That makes sense. One, tycoon games, from my understanding, from Marissa, thank you, is that they're essentially idle games that suck now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, they used to be basically sort of proto-idle games, and I remember them. They were, you know, I had fun with them. It was just waiting around for shit, but there was a block that dropped and then, you know, mm-hmm. went across a conveyor belt. That was fun. That was interesting. But nowadays, a lot of them are just kind of, eh. They're just kind of, you know, passively building income and then randomly buying things occasionally. Two, Chainsmokers. I know that there are bands that, like, sound bad just from the name of them, but aren't. Bare Naked Ladies did a song in Chicken Little. Like, that, they did the opening song of Chicken Little.
They did the opening song of Big Bang Theory as well, thank you.
Yeah.
Bare Naked Ladies kind of slaps.
Bare Naked Ladies, we stand Bare Naked Ladies.
They made 1 week, which admittedly does have the weird line about Sailor Moon, but let's brush that aside. Honestly, odds are and Pinch Me make up for it.
But Chainsmokers, even if the name was not fucking Chainsmokers, they make songs about sex.
Yeah.
I you know, again, I don't mean to be Puritan here. Like, all due nuance. The on the face of it, the like, hey, we're gonna do a Chainsmokers branded content on Roblox and make it a tycoon game, has the same energy of like, I don't even know. It's like they saw Fortnite doing things successfully and were like, we can do that too. But who can we pull? Chainsmokers, are they doing anything?
I can't wait for Slipknot Dodgeball in Roblox.
Yeah. Fucking, God.
This isn't even to mention the numerous anime knockoff games. Oh yeah, you know Tokyo Ghoul? You know who loves Tokyo Ghoul? Eight-year-olds. They love it so much they want to play the shitty Tokyo Ghoul Lego game.
Oh man, I can't wait for I really can't wait for Steely Dan's Destroy the Noob game on Roblox.
Yeah, I can't wait for the Seinfeld obby. Wait, that probably does exist.
Ah damn.
Yeah, okay, so we've gone a little too far down this road. I need to make us turn around a bunch
to complete the Seinfeld lobby. You have to get through the whole thing without jerking off. Sorry.
Okay, so speaking of the 2000s,
yeah,
this is the year of the album. We're talking about albums this year. Our goal is to talk about more than one album.
Yes.
And this is the first of the two albums we have planned so far. Here's just sort of a bit of what's the word? Testimonial. So, growing up, I had two older siblings who bought CDs. I was too young to buy CDs. The only CDs I really bought as a kid were the Sonic Adventure 2 soundtrack and the Sonic Heroes soundtrack, and they're still in my CD collection.
Based. Absolutely fucking based.
But a lot of my musical tastes were fueled by my siblings, and a lot of what they listened to was pop punk and emo of the 2000s. I guess it was mainly, like, a lot of it was mostly stuff my sister listened to, but The band that stuck out to me probably the most at the time, and still does, is Fall Out Boy. Fall Out Boy is really cool and interesting, and their history is really weird. They're a band I respect in that they have never, it's never felt like they have been compelled to keep their style or their sound. Like, every Fall Out Boy album sounds different, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Now, me and a lot of other Fall Out Boy fans that I know are not big fans of the direction they've taken since Save Rock and Roll. But, I mean, it's interesting, and I don't I don't want to blame them for changing up their sound. Now, the album we're talking about today, in my opinion, is peak Fall Out Boy.
Yes.
This is my third favorite album of all time. We've already talked about the second on this podcast.
And we will talk about the first if you hit that subscribe button.
Hell yeah, hit that bell. We're not on YouTube yet.
Rate us 5 stars. There probably is a podcasting platform that actually has a 5-star
most
rating.
Of them, actually.
Ah, damn it.
Most podcasting platforms use 5 stars.
Only rate this 5 stars if you're on YouTube.
Otherwise, give it a like, a thumbs up. Yeah, so we're talking about Infinity on High, and it sounds like it's time for the Fact Corner.
The Fact Corner.
Okay, so Infinity on High was released in 2007 under Island Records. It was the first Fall Out Boy album to be released under Island Records. Previously, they were under Fueled by Ramen, which was a like smaller pop-punk emo label that also had signed Panic at the Disco and Paramore, for example.
Fueled by Ramen is still pretty active and still pretty sort of on the scene, from my understanding.
Yeah. The lyrics of Fall Out Boy's music are always written by Pete Wentz, the bassist of the band, and the rest of the music is composed largely by Patrick Stump, the frontman and singer, though on Infinity on High, some of the guitar parts were written by their other guitarist, Joe Troman. This is sort of this really interesting collaborative songwriting process. I feel like in a lot of bands, you either have the primary songwriter, or you have like Beatles or Queen would do, like, each member writes their own songs, but they wrote the entire song.
Yeah.
So you know when it's like a Paul song or a Ringo song.
Yeah.
Whereas Fall Out Boy has a very collaborative process, where Pete Wentz kind of just writes the lyrics out up front, and Patrick Stump is like, all right, given these, what do I do? A bit about like Fall Out Boy's history. So they are from Wilmette, which is a suburb in Chicago, and they regularly remind you of that fact. A lot of their songs reference the suburbs in this regard, or reference some part of Chicago. For example, there was a single that released a long time ago, but was re-released in like 2018 or so, called Lake Effect Kid. And Lake Effect is referring to, is it Lake Erie? The one that's next to Chicago?
You're definitely asking the right person.
Yeah.
I'm Lake going Erie. To go with Lake Inferior.
Sure. So we mentioned that they were released, or they were originally signed to Fueled by Ramen, but they also kind of toured and collaborated with a ton of other pop punk and emo groups. So there's Panic at the Disco, where they've collaborated on a number of songs together. They also collaborated with Newfound Glory, Cobra Starship, and, you know, that one Gym Class Heroes song. They might not necessarily be emo, but Fall Out Boy did collaborate with them. You know the one.
You know the one.
You know the one. So, their first album, Take This to Your Grave, was released in 2003 and was kind of unknown. It was not the most popular album. It didn't chart, but it developed a small fan base. Now, come 2005, when they released From Under the Cork Tree, and they kind of blew up overnight. From Under the Cork Tree was a huge album. It was their first album to chart. They went from below 200 on the Billboard to number 9. They were also nominated for Best New Artist at the Grammys, despite it being their second album. That was largely due to two of the singles, Sugar We're Going Down and Dance Dance.
Yes, I was about to ask if this is Dance Dance. Dance Dance. So I just want to interject here with my own personal history. My music tastes were not actually shaped by my sibling, because my brother listened to a lot of country and a lot of bad country and bad hip hop is what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Like country and hip hop are genres that everybody always says like, oh, I like everything but these two. And like, there's a lot of hip hop I like. There's a lot of country I like. Not as much modern country. Modern country has a lot of issues. But you know, I don't want to paint a wide brush here. However, I also had access to YouTube at this time, and I very distinctly remember constantly trying to find a decent quality version of Dance Dance, because I fucking loved that song, but it was my white whale. I could never find, like, that good, crispy 240p, which was the style at the time, video of a prom dance. It's I have very succinct memories of, like, wanting to get into this kind of band. And, of course, I was also a baby of Tony Hawk's Underground, and so the sort of, like, alt to, like, you know, underground-y, pop-punk-ish style really appealed to me at the time.
I just had the CD. I just had it on my iPod. MP3 player.
I had a couple of CDs, but they were family CDs. They were not. I had the Shrek soundtrack on CD.
I also have the Shrek soundtrack on CD. It's over there on my CD shelf.
It slaps.
It's so good.
Unironic fucking banger. We're gonna have to do an episode over that one day.
So yeah, part of this was the music video for Sugar We're Going Down being just incredibly iconic. And ultimately, yeah, that added to From Under the Cork Tree charting at 9th on the Billboard charts and putting the band under a ton of pressure. The pressure normally felt for like a sophomoric release was put on them for the third album because people just kind of ignored that their first album even existed.
Yeah.
So Infinity on High finally then released in 2007, which was 2 years after Cork Tree, and it brought with them a lot of experimentation. Cork Tree wasn't super different in sound from Take This to Your Grave. I think in a previous Talk Surfer, I had said that Take This to Your Grave sounded like a bunch of Less Than Jake demos that were left over and taken the horns out. And From Under the Cork Tree is a bit more unique. They definitely went into their style at that time, kind of came into their own. But I think Infinity on High is really interesting because, like, for their third album, they started integrating more instruments than just, like, the traditional rock quartet. They brought in piano, violin, horns, a bunch of really fun things like that. And what came out of that is their first number one charting album with 3 or 4 beloved singles and just one of the best albums of the generation.
Yeah.
One of the best pop punk albums.
Yeah.
So
this album had like 5 singles that blew up from it.
It was This Ain't a Scene, and Thanks for the Memories.
The Takes Over, The Breaks Over, I believe.
Yeah. And then I believe Carpal Tunnel of Love was another single.
I want to say that Hum Hallelujah was pretty big for a while. Maybe. While I personally love it, I don't think it is as like constantly regarded as things like Thanks for the Memories nowadays.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like just an insane amount of like specific that one songs.
And Thanks for the Memories was like 1 or 2 on the Billboard singles chart.
Yeah.
It was very up there. So before we go into the song by song, I do want to sort of note the Fall Out Boy style, because I think you can't really escape the Fall Out Boy isms, and those have sort of become synonymous with the band to where when people talk about the band, they often talk about the Fall Out Boy isms. So first off is the song titles. This is unavoidable. So in Cork Tree, they had a lot of movie quote song titles.
Yes.
Cork Tree had Of All the Gin Joints in All the World and A Little Less 16 Candles, A Little More Touch Me, which is not a movie quote, but references a movie. Infinity on High doesn't really have that, but it still has some very wordy titles that are like sentences.
Yeah.
Like, I've got all this ringing in my ears, but none in my fingers. It also has just some really wacky ones that don't seem to really mesh with the song. Like, they will have some that involve the song title or the part of the chorus in the song title, but then you have stuff like The Takeover, The Breaks Over, or Fame Is Less Than Infamy that like they kind of relate, but they don't.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's part of the fun of bands like these is like the fact that the song titles don't have to match the song content, I think makes a difference. Some of them I think are super iconic because of that.
Yeah. Thanks for the Memories is in some part of it made by the fact that the title has no vowels.
Yeah.
Like they don't sing it as Thanks for the Memories, but like, and they do actually have the line in the song, but like what an insanely great way, and what an insanely great story of like, we took the vowels out because the record label was constantly like, your titles are too long.
Yeah, very, very sweet. They have a lot of great titles, but I think what I more want to talk about is the way they write lyrics, or the way Pete Wentz writes lyrics. So Fall Out Boy is one-liner focused. Most of their songs are like one-liner after one-liner, going into the chorus, which will have some punchy, like, the lyrics that kind of They're not one-liners. They have a setup and ending in the chorus itself rather than just, like, the single line having both of those.
Yeah.
But Pete Wentz is, like, he's good at writing, like, I haven't looked at his Twitter, but he writes, like, tweets almost.
Yeah.
They're, like, stand-up bits. They're, like... They're one-liners. The content of the line is sort of self-contained in a little bit of wordplay or a joke. And not many of their songs are like story songs or things like that. Oftentimes their songs are a collection of these one-liners that, much like a book of poetry, coalesce into a lyric.
So I'm going to make a little assertion here, which I might regret years down the line, but I'm just going to make it here. So, in my mind, there are two distinct styles of songwriting. Not the only two, but, like, here is a list of two of them. There is a song that has so much forward momentum that you forget there's a chorus. Like, the prime example in my mind is Holland 1945. I literally didn't realize that had a chorus, because I consider the song just one stream of consciousness. It's great. Then you have, like, the mic drop, where, like, you know, you have a verse or a chorus that comes up to a head, and, you know, it's meant to have a fucking banger line that you then drop, and then, you know, have a bit of breathing room. It feels like Fall Out Boy kind of writes mic drops with a stream of consciousness. Like you said, they put in a lot of one-liners, but it never loses momentum.
Yeah. So structurally, their songs are usually verse, chorus, bridge, chorus.
Yeah.
With sometimes they'll have a post-chorus. Most of the time they'll have a post-chorus. Sometimes they'll have a pre-chorus. I think it's that the one-liners usually have at least something to do with one another, or they're at least categorized by theme such that they fit a verse as a verse.
Yeah.
And then I think that they're really good at writing choruses and bridges. The amount of repetition in a chorus, I think, is something that they have a fine grasp on, both in terms of Wentz's lyrics and Stump's composition. And I'll get to that as far as, like, there's some songs on this album I want to highlight specifically for that.
Yeah.
And then their bridges are incredible. This is something I'm stealing from Bill Buds, the podcast. They said that Fall Out Boy is really good with bridges. And I got to agree, Fall Out Boy makes a good bridge. I like bridges.
Personally, I dig canals.
I dig canals. Yeah. And I think both of those lead to a sense of flow in the song that doesn't feel like it's repeating itself too much.
Yeah.
Even though it's structured as a typical pop song, it doesn't feel repetitive the way a pop song is. Their songs have sort of a narrative to them in terms of the way chord structure is used or chord progression, the way the pitch works and sort of the way the melody travels. I'm not sure I used all those words correctly, but yeah, I can see what you mean. And I think that'll be easier to explain as we go on.
Yes.
And so I guess let's go into it.
Yeah. So the opener song here, Thriller, it's just Michael Jackson's Thriller. It's really weird that they open with it.
Yeah.
This was actually a fun first experience with me because, I can actually just admit this now. I was quite high when I first really listened to this album. It's legal in Missouri, so yay. And so when I heard the opening, I was like, wait a minute, I know what this is from.
Yeah. So I had sampled the okay, it starts with Jay-Z, which yes. is cool. He says some stuff about, like, you know, this album is for the people who couldn't make it, and it's for the fans that stayed with us the whole time. Stuff like that. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But I sampled it in my second mashup album, Casual Lobby.
Yeah, yeah. The Photon Punch classic, Casual Lobby. Really fucking good. Like, it's a really good sample. Like,
yeah.
It gives you the sort of, like, I think it presupposes a sort of, like, you know, a community, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you feel ready to be part of whatever is next.
Yeah, I love how it is an introduction. It is also just a dedication on an album. Like, people
yes.
don't do that.
Yes.
People don't dedicate things that aren't books and sometimes movies. And I love that.
It's really cool.
And then, yeah, it's like, it starts from the sort of just sort of passive strumming and plucking into the full-on hard guitar, like, banging down on it. The first song, Thriller, is sort of... It is in the perspective of the band talking about their experience suddenly blowing up.
Yeah.
The line is like, last summer we took threes across the board, but by fall we were a cover story in Stars.
Now in stores.
I thought it was Stars, like the magazine.
So, spoiler alert, I have... That's actually real. That would have been really good.
Because they're a cover story.
Yeah, it's that. That would have been really
Anyways.
Good.
Anyways.
So, spoiler alert, I have Spotify open for the lyrics as I'm going through my notes here. I don't know if this is a Fall Out Boy specific thing, but for a very long time, I thought that I just didn't know lyrics to things.
No, Fall Out Boy is... Okay, so it's funny you bring this up.
Yes. Fall Out Boy is Patrick Stump. I love him. Love you, Patrick Stump.
Great singer,
but sometimes indecipherable.
Shitty enunciator.
Yeah.
So one of YouTube's pastimes was misheard lyrics videos.
Yeah, Buffaloxing.
Or Mondegreens?
Mondegreens.
And Fall Out Boy was a prime target for this. Pretty much every song on this album had a Miss Her Lyrics video or three. I was going to bring that up when we get to This Ain't a Scene, because that's one of the most notable ones.
Yeah.
And honestly, from what I've heard, a lot of people found the band through the Misheard Lyrics videos for Corktree.
I'm not surprised.
It's just, yeah, Patrick Stump, he sings with enough ambiguity in the words. Also, Spotify has some lyrics that are wrong. I can tell you the song in particular that is wrong, and it's towards the back half of the album.
Interesting. That'll be fun.
Yeah. So yeah, it's sort of a sort of very self-aware, reflective on their place in the scene now. I love the I found the safest place to keep all our mistakes. Every .com's refreshing for a journal update.
Yeah.
Like, the safest place to keep mistakes is the thing all these fans are rapidly refreshing to look for.
Yeah.
They're so hungry to see your current, like, thoughts. Fall Out Boy was part of what made pop emo such a thing was MySpace. I feel like this isn't exactly a controversial take.
Yeah.
But, like, these were bands, a lot of the Fueled by Ramen bands, you know, Fall Out Boy, Panic, Paramore, and then MCR as well, but I'm not sure what record label they were signed to. Like, they all partially got big because of the internet, allowing access to both the music videos, and just sort of the fan experience. And MySpace being this social network that had this huge, like, music integration of, like, putting your favorite songs on your page and stuff.
Yeah.
And following pages from other bands. It was such a important thing for this, like, mid-ground music scene. Not super indie, but not mainstream yet.
Yeah. It had there was a certain mystique about, like, being able to follow your favorite band, especially your favorite band that, like, wasn't popular in a lot of other contexts.
Yeah, and was kind of angsty and edgy. Yeah, Panic at the Disco also has songs about this sort of era.
Yeah. My personal line from the song, which is the general line of the chorus, is "Cry on the couch, all the poets come to life, fix me in 45."
Mm-hmm.
While the Spotify version of the album and other versions of the album are about an hour long, the original version was 47 minutes long. And so it's a pretty obvious allusion. This song sets up a consistent theme for the rest of it, which is like the sort of... It's interesting because it's like, it is a play on the arrogance of the band, but also sort of like bemoaning their place. It's like, we're the voice of a generation, but also we have the pressure of people looking at us now.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, they like to play around with this sort of preconceived like image of themselves a lot in this album, where it's like they self-aggrandize, but kind of to the extent of self-depreciation.
Mm-hmm. The way I put it is that they have a lot of songs that add up to We Are Magic Boys.
Yeah.
Maybe not Thriller necessarily, but the next one will. It's this sort of this lyrical statement of like, it's like a manic pixie dream boy.
Yeah.
Like, they are presenting themselves as like powerful and mysterious and cool and dark and handsome, but also like damaged and broken. They're like Komaida. Yeah, the Fix Me in 45 is interesting. There's a few sort of allusions that has. Because it also, as far as like Pete Wentz has said, it refers to the duration of a therapy session.
Ah.
It's 45 minutes. But also, it refers to a 45-inch LP.
Ah, that's really cool.
it's multifaceted. It's a triple entendre. I also got to point out the line, "Long live the car crash hearts," is a reference to a Smith song, which, like, apparently all of these mid-2000s, early-2000s artists just fucked with the Smiths.
Oh, God. I love songs that reference other songs directly so much.
Yeah, I love it. But, like, he literally says, "I can take your problem away with a nod and a wave of my hand," because that's just the kind of boy that I am.
Yeah.
That's the sort of prime example of what I mean by the magic boy.
Yeah.
We're just special magic boys. It's also interesting because, like, they have a lot of these songs that are written from the perspective not of the singer as a character, but of the band as a whole, where it's we, not I.
Yeah.
And while they do have a lot of I's, mainly in that second verse, the first verse and the chorus are the we's, you know?
Yeah.
It is interesting that the song splits itself from we, and it's like the narrative part, and then I, and it's the one-liners and stuff with, like, "the only thing I haven't done yet is die."
Yeah. Banger opener. Really, really good tone setter. Really good thesis.
Yep. Go into the sort of outro of the song, which is more of that heavy strumming, into the second song, Snap Cut, Take Over the Breaks Over. Fucking, like, really good song.
Yeah.
I love the chorus of this song. For one thing, because Patrick Stump does not often sing the same line more than once the same time. When he sings the chorus, he likes to change up the pitch or the tone or something about the way he sings the chorus.
Yeah.
So in the first time he sings the chorus, he says, "style your way through fashion magazines," and it goes down. And in the second one, he goes, "style your way through fashion magazines," and then he does like a little oh, oh, oh type of thing. So it keeps the chorus feeling fresh, even though it's ultimately repetitive. Also, this has the line, "wouldn't you rather be a widow than a divorcee?"
Yes.
Which, like, holy shit.
A consistent theme in songs I like is sort of like, don't you wish things were worse?
Yeah.
From a romantic sense, essentially, not, "I don't literally wish things were worse. Don't cancel me on Twitter," or whatever. Now, I love the idea of, you know, the sort of like letting the art sort of presuppose the morality, essentially, of like, there's something beautiful to being a widow that there isn't in being a divorcee, but that also means that you kind of wish for death.
There's also this bit of like, if you're a widow, that means that you have loved for life.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very complicated thing, you know, the circumstances of staying in a marriage versus leaving one. And I think that line's really cool. This song always felt like it was being sung specifically to someone, but also it is still in the context of being suddenly rocketed to fame.
Yeah.
You know, there's the bit about like headlines and flash photography. Like, it still feels like they are being reflective or introspective of their rise to fame and being in the spotlight, being the topic of like tabloids and stuff. Though in this case, it seems to be in the framework of like maybe a love song, maybe just talking to a woman. Don't know. Also, I want to say we wanted to release this earlier because this was going to be a sad excuse for a Valentine's Day episode, because there are a few love songs on here.
Yeah, I had a perfect opening too, which was I was going to be like, "yeah, and it's me, Galen. I've completed my transition to a 90s nerd because I went on a Valentine's date with my mom."
And then I was going to do the Muscle Man bit where I'm like, "you know who else went on a Valentine's date? My mom." And then, so we ended up working that in there eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, the joke was not wasted. Or was it? Yeah. Take Over the Breaks Over. It has this really, really funky sort of guitar line with a lot of rests between the notes, which I love. It kind of jumps between two specific notes. You know, it's do-dee, do-dee. And there's something about that sort of simplicity in that I think is really fun.
Yeah.
It's not a complicated line until it gets to the bridge where there is this really neat guitar solo with Patrick Stump just kind of screaming in the background.
Yeah.
Next song is This Ain't a Scene, It's an Arms Race, which is one of the singles off the album, one of the most famous songs off the album.
Possibly one of the most famous songs that they've made.
It's one of my least favorite songs on the album.
Really?
It might be because it's been kind of overplayed.
That's extremely fair.
I will say, I really like the bridge to this one. The guitar, it almost does the Smells Like Teen Spirit thing of the guitar playing the vocal melody.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. But it feels like it does. But it doesn't.
But it doesn't.
So if the other two, if the previous two were sort of retrospective, this is looking to the future in terms of their position in the music industry. The title, This Ain't a Scene, It's an Arms Race, is like really sort of accelerate, like music is going to die out quickly in terms of an artist's popularity unless you bring something new and punchy.
Yeah.
And the turning of things from of like the popular genre from punk to pop punk to emo pop is itself a sort of violent takeover.
If there is one thing I could say for this song, it's that I think once you get the metaphor, it's obvious.
Yeah.
It's not hard to get the metaphor.
Yeah, it beats you pretty over the head with it.
Yeah, which, you know, is also a style. I'm certainly not a I am somebody who is more than willing to accept, I know people who use subtext and they're all cowards, but for a band and for an album that is so often very poetic, this one is more sort of obvious than a lot of their other ones.
Yeah.
But I will say, the chorus itself, when it picks up, I fucking love.
Yeah. So this was the Misheard Lyrics.
Yeah.
Is that within the Misheard Lyrics sort of community, there were a few camps as far as what the lyrics could be. Never what it was, you know, nobody cares about the real definition.
Yeah.
But it's, are you a Lysol eater or are you also evil?
Yeah. I was definitely also evil.
I'm a little man is always the one to go before that.
Yeah.
And after it is always also into cats.
Yeah. See,
but the middle part, this is like Barça Mikos versus Dance on the O's.
Yeah.
This is that for Fall Out Boy. It's are you also evil or are you a Lysol eater?
Do you hear Laurel or Yanni in this particular
song? Are you a goddamn ass face or a Gotham arse race?
Is Pete Wentz wearing a blue and white shirt or is Patrick Stump wearing a yellow and black shirt?
Yeah. So I will say the repetition of the title, it kind of reminds me of like Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
Against the Machine's thing was treating lyrics as political slogans. And so they would repeat the lines in the lyrics, which normally would be repetitive, but to them it was to enforce the message.
Yeah.
So that's why they
killing in the name of.
Yeah. Killing in the Name Of is pretty much just some of those that join forces are the same that burn crosses. It gets you to memorize it.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of the idea behind This Ain't a Scene, is it is just reinforcing that idea, eventually being picked up by, like, a chorus of fans singing along to it.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's the part in the concert where they would, like, turn on all the lights and the people in the stands would sing and the band would stop playing. A lot of bands have one of those.
Yeah. Big come on crowd moments.
Big man your own jackhammer.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I want to go to an Aquabats concert so bad.
That's pretty good. Streetlight also does that a lot.
Hell yeah.
The fuck it, thank you, I love you all.
Oh man.
So yeah, that part's cool. Here's sort of a fun game you can play. So when we were little, my mom would, whenever certain songs would come on the radio, she would do this thing where she would rapidly increase the volume just for one beat. The two songs were Kung Fu Fighting
nice.
And Who Let the Dogs Out.
Nice.
So the idea was when it goes ho in Kung Fu Fighting, you just take the volume knob and you just crank it all the way very briefly.
So you get the ho.
Yeah. And then similarly for Who Let the Dogs, it's the who. But so I was driving my car with my mom in the passenger seat and this song came on Spotify and I did that for the goddamn.
Yeah.
And my mom died. And I was like, yeah, that's the one I had in my pocket for a long time. So if you have a knob volume control on your car, you can do that.
Oh yeah. Man, knob volume controls are going the way of the printing press.
Sure. yeah, This Ain't a Scene. It's a popular song, and I get it. I just think it's kind of boring, especially compared to a lot of the other songs on the album that are just melodically interesting, rhythmically interesting, lyrically complicated. I don't know.
But it does make good mashup material.
Oh, yeah.
Second allusion to Casual Lobby here, yeah. Folks. Go listen to and then watch Casual Lobby.
Yeah. So fifth song is I'm Like a Lawyer, The Way I'm Always Trying to Get You Off, parentheses, me and you. Guess which part of that title appears in the lyrics? So this is like one of the actual love songs on the album. And I think it's funny, in an interview, I believe Pete Wentz talked about how like they included this song as just a tried and true love song. And that was like one of the only times they were ever going to do a typical love song.
Yeah.
And it's also kind of right before the turning point of the album, I think. So it's sort of a last breath of air before the descent, if you will.
Yeah.
This is one I always had a hard time understanding. The whole second verse does not sound like what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, this is one.
Also, I don't like the way it's written. Like, the lyrics are kind of weird. The tree I used to lay beneath kissed tear-stained red.
This is one that I have very little notes on because I just kind of listened to it and was like, okay. It's not bad, but it is one where I'm just sort of like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
This is a song.
There's not a lot to mention in this one. I do like the instrumentation. The drums, bass, and rhythm guitar are all kind of together, though the bass kind of fills in the gaps, but it feels like they're playing the syncopated parts, and the drums and the rhythm guitar play it together to where it's this huge punch every other beat.
Yeah.
In between those, I think, is like a little bit of the bass line, and then just Patrick Stump singing, which leads to this very sort of ambly sound. Like, you're just kind of walking. It's not walking in the sense that a walking bass line is, like, progressing through the notes in a certain way. But it feels just like the sound of footsteps or heartbeats.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun. Next song is much more interesting, though. Hum Hallelujah. They actually have Hallelujah in the bridge for Hum Hallelujah.
Yes.
It's not a Christmas song. It's funny, because they had this, and then All American Rejects had a song that has Pachelbel's Canon and D in the bridge. And it was like, these are two, like, songs that feel very, like, one of them's not a classic song. Hallelujah is not a classical song.
Yeah.
But it feels very similar in concept of the bridge being this other composition that's kind of highly regarded.
Yeah. So Fall Out Boy uses religious imagery a lot to very, very good effect, I would consider.
Mainly on this album.
Yeah, is that specific to this one?
I think so.
Because does this have, like, my favorite... It does have my favorite fucking line. This is the one I by far have the most to say about. Hum Hallelujah feels like it is a song explicitly interrogating the relationship between a band and their fans.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the line I'm specifically referring to is, I love you in the same way there's chapels in a hospital. Which is a banger.
Yeah.
Like to me, the line reads as like, the idea is there, but it's hollow, which is both a really good fucking line, a really poetic line, and also a really good, like, take that against chapels.
It's also this sense of like, it's a necessity to help people feel a sense of normality and belonging and comfort. But it's ultimately a one-sided relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
I always love where a bull, your ears are just a china shop.
Yes.
Which, you know, your favorite fun fact about that saying.
Bull in a china shop.
That Mythbusters proved it to be wrong?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, wow, are you saying that your words ring hollow to me? Pete Wentz, lyricist of the generation.
Your lyrics are trying to make their way into my, or trying to crash into my brain, but unfortunately for you, bulls are actually really docile when in china shops. Mm-hmm. And so it's simply swirling around there.
Yeah. Also, I also love the line, I could write it better than you ever felt it.
Yes.
Like, you know, having gone through some really serious depression, that feels super real. Of, like, not just the this being another magic boy element, but being, like, in when you are so depressed that you can't really feel extreme emotions like that, music is, like, your closest thing sometimes.
Yeah. Along that line along a similar vein but different line is, I sing the blues and you swallow them too, which, mm-hmm. to me, once more, kind of, like, plays to the arrogance, but I don't think this is an arrogant song, specifically because of the lines, "One day we'll get nostalgic for disaster," and "One foot in your bedroom and one foot out the door."
Yeah.
Which reads like very, it's fleeting and it knows it's fleeting. They understand that the days that they are here to comfort you are going to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
The days of them being your favorite band is absolutely going to die out.
Yeah. I also just love, so going back to religious imagery, there's obviously the hallelujah in sort of the chorus and the bridge, but also want to point out the road outside my house is paved with good intentions.
Yes.
That's the road to hell. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. He lives in hell or proximity to hell. Keep that in mind, I will say. I want to retouch on the religious allusions after we go through all the songs in sort of the wrap-up portion of this episode.
Yeah.
Next is Golden. Golden, okay, so I used to hate Golden when I was little because I felt like it broke up the pace. But now, an enlightened adult, I like it in that it's so different from the rest of this album in most of their albums. It's maybe like the least Fall Out Boy song Fall Out Boy has ever made.
Yeah.
And I love that. It is only Patrick Stump in a piano. It's this like bluesy sort of sad,
like ballad almost.
Ballad, yeah. It's like it feels like a song in a musical, or like, you know, it has this theatrical dramatic element to it. It's so interesting. It's like this weird it lament.
It feels like the solo piano version of a previous song, but it isn't. It's on its own.
God, the fucking line, "I saw God cry in the reflection of my enemies."
So good. That's like a song out of fucking Streetlight Manifesto.
It's so good. It's just so weird that like this is a Fall Out Boy song. And I think that's part of the experimentation of Infinity on High, that like this is them really trying to branch out, you know, from being just a punk band. And one of those things was to just have this sort of halfway point checkmark of a song that is a quiet interlude.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of the second act of a three-act symphony being this quiet, slow thing.
Hum Hallelujah is the sort of, like, breakpoint into, like, the descent, but Golden is sort of, like, the literal breakpoint of the album.
Yeah, the low point, the bottom. Leading into Thanks for the Memories, which is maybe one of their most famous songs. I think it's their second most famous after Sugar We're Going Down.
Yeah. Am I more than you bargained for yet?
Maybe.
I have a little fun fact, little copy-paste from the Wikipedia page of this particular song. Ahem. The song is featured in a track pack for Band Hero and Guitar Hero 5, and also available for DLC on the video game series Lips, Rocksmith, Rock Band Free, and Beat Saber. It is also featured in the game, and we're gonna have a fun quiz here. What game is this song featured in, not as DLC?
Is it a rhythm game?
It is. The hint I will give you, it is for the Wii.
Is it Boogie?
Yes!
Yes!
Boogie Superstar for the Wii is the only song that had this song in the base game.
Why was Boogie a video game? I hate that game. That game makes me so mad.
Dance, but don't do the same dance motion fucking three times in a row, idiot. It's like Samba de Amigo, but it sucks.
It's so bad. It's like Major Minor's Majestic March, but with real music. God, I can't believe I pulled that. I was like, that sounds like a song that would be in Boogie. So Thanks for the Memories is fine. I like the... It's so dramatic. Like, it starts with, like, not flugelhorn, but it's almost a sousaphone, maybe tuba.
I do not know my brass
going into a violin line that sounds like it's going to go into like an axe murderer.
Yeah,
it's like the Psycho violin.
Yeah,
and you know it's super dramatic going into then the chorus, which is sort of a party. So here's a really fun thing: the lyric is, "See, he tastes like you, only sweeter." And this is supposed to be sung by a third person to the main perspective of the song.
Yeah.
This is a woman that the singer had a one-night stand with. But I like to think this is a bisexual anthem.
Yeah. Yeah.
because it's the male singer talking to a woman saying this other guy tastes like you, only sweeter.
I for a very long time literally interpreted it like that.
Yeah, like why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah,
the rest of the song is in first person.
This is one of the only things I specifically looked up, because this is also a song, or a lyric, a line from a play and movie. I don't remember the name of the movie slash play, but according to Pete Wentz, specifically his annotation on Genius, he used that line because it's a perfect line in his eyes of, like, wanting to know something and then suddenly being told too much information.
Yeah.
Which is really good. But yeah, I personally always heard this as a bisexual anthem of the guy going on to have a one night stand with another guy and going like, yeah, he tastes like you, but sweeter.
Yeah. The bridge goes into this like flamenco bit of acoustic guitar. And I don't remember the name of the percussive instrument, but it's always sounds like a hand crank.
Oh yeah.
But I love that middle part where it just breaks from the dramatic overproduction of like an entire symphony into just acoustic guitar.
Yeah, the do 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 do.
Yeah. That whole bit is great. It's a great bridge to a song that otherwise I feel like gets, I'm kind of tired of it just because of how popular it is. I think if I had discovered this album later on without living through the time period where it was a huge album,
yeah,
I would like the song more, but it's something that I feel like I've just eaten too much and I've gotten over the taste.
Yeah.
Like a glazed donut.
Yeah, I can only taste so many sweet things before I'm tired of them.
Thanks for the Memories is fine, though. It doesn't have the vowels. Taking the vowel out of words does not make them sound cooler, as per so-and-so. Hey, this is post-production Matt. Unfortunately, this episode ended up going way over time because we had a lot to talk about, and so I'm going to be cutting it here for a two-parter. So, for my sign-off for now, thank you for listening. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you want. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review, let us know how we're doing, let us know what you want us to cover or things we should check out. You can follow us on Twitter at NetServerPro, where we post teasers on upcoming episodes and other sort of project status reports. You can follow me on Twitter at Twakaroo, Twakaroo, where I post updates on how I'm doing, my thoughts on various games and things, as well as project updates for my own stuff, and when I go live on my stream on twitch.tv/twak, twitch.tv/twak. I stream weekdays at sometime around noon Central Time, and I play a lot of competitive games, a lot of roguelites, a lot of interesting and weird single-player games. I've been playing a lot of Hitman because of the new Freelancer mode, and as of uploading this, I just finished Hi-Fi Rush, so you can check that out. That was a great game. And then you can follow Galen on Twitter at GalenWilson0n. And you can follow him on Tumblr on Galen Wilson without the zero. And I believe TikTok is with a zero? One of those. I don't normally do his part. But thanks for listening, and we'll resume with the back half of the album next time.